Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, Ashley and I will bring you stories, along with Brian Lynn. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, history's most frightening dinosaur, the Tyrannosaurus Rex, came from a long line of smaller creatures. Scientists have identified a new relative of the Tyrannosaurus Rex, also known as T-Rex. Scientists say this relative was only about 1 meter high, the height of a small child. American Sterling Nesbitt, a paleontologist, discovered the dinosaur. He told the Associated Press that if the ancient creature raised its head, an adult human maybe would be looking at it in the eye. Nesbitt is with the Virginia Polytechnic Institute and State University in Blacksburg, Virginia. In 1998, he found the creature's remains while serving as a volunteer on a dig in New Mexico with a famous paleontologist. At the time, Nesbitt was just 16 years old. For about 20 years, scientists were not sure what to make of the remains until other small relatives of T-Rex were discovered. The small group of tyrannosauroid dinosaurs would give rise to some of the biggest predators that we've ever seen, noted Nesbitt. He is the lead author of a report of the bones. The findings were published earlier this month in the scientific journal Nature, Ecology, and Evolution. The new dinosaur is called Susquehannas hazelae. The name comes from a word in the language of the Zuni, a Native American tribe. It describes another small but modern predator, the coyote. Scientists say the dinosaur dates back 92 million years, about 20 million years before the T-Rex walked the Earth. The newly discovered cousin weighed between about 20 and 40 kilograms. It was 3 times longer than it was tall. That is almost nothing compared to the 9-ton T-Rex. Susquehannas hazelae is not the first or even smallest member of the Tyrannosaurus family tree. But Nesbitt said it provides the best example of how this family of smaller dinosaurs evolved into the frightening star of movies and television shows. Hans-Dieter Seuss is a paleobiologist with the Smithsonian Institution in Washington. He suggested it was an important find. Susquehannas is the first really good record of the early tyrannosaurs in North America, he wrote in an email. He was not involved in the study. Scientists are not sure why these meat eaters were not especially big compared with other dinosaurs alive at the time. So it is unclear why they later evolved to be so huge. Nesbitt said the newly discovered species is probably among the last of the little dinosaurs. It was bigger than earlier members of the species and had big feet needed for speed, something the T-Rex lost.
The kinds of birds coming through your neighborhood are probably changing, and so is the timing of their migrations. Bird watchers noticing these differences are playing a big part in understanding how climate change and severe weather events are affecting bird populations. John Roden is Director of Community Conservation at the National Audubon Society, which aims to protect birds and their environments. He said, birders have to be much more alert to when birds are coming through than they used to be, since birds may be coming through much earlier or much later. Birdwatchers are increasingly seeing birds in their area that are usually found elsewhere, Roden says, and they are seeing fewer of the birds that usually travel through. Just because we've seen these birds year after year doesn't mean they'll always be there. They are declining in numbers because we are throwing so many things at them. So we need to do what we can to help them, Roden said. At least 314 species of American birds are expected to lose 50% or more of their range by the end of the century. Those species are listed by the Audubon Society as climate-threatened or endangered, Roden added. A United Nations science report issued Monday says 1 million species of plants and animals are at risk of disappearing from Earth. Scientists who issued the report blamed development that has led to loss of habitat, as well as climate change, overfishing, pollution, and invasive species. Environmentalists say there are a few easy steps people can take to help struggling bird populations. These include planting native species, which leads to more native insects for the birds to eat. The Audubon Society's Plants for Birds website provides plant suggestions for people in the United States based on where they live in the country. During spring and fall migration seasons, people can help migrating birds by keeping outdoor lights turned off and covering reflective surfaces like large windows. People also should make indoor plants less visible to passing birds. The Audubon Society also runs a community science program called Climate Watch. It aims to collect data on how bird ranges, or the places they are found, are changing. Roden says the program asks people to count the numbers of each species they see. The program goes from May 15th to June 15th. Jeff LeBaron, director of the Christmas Bird Count at the National Audubon Society, says he has seen the effects of climate change firsthand. "I've been a birder since I was a little kid," he said. "It's clear that climate change is affecting and will continue to affect birds on a global scale. And it's a question of whether or not they can adapt to what the climate is throwing at them." Record droughts, floods, hurricanes, and more are having a major effect, he said. Hurricanes usually happen during migration season, LeBaron noted. They have an especially big effect on seabirds, whose migration paths might change by thousands of kilometers as a result.
Plastic remains one of the most used materials for making many of the things we use in our everyday lives. Things made of plastic can be very strong and last a long time. They also do well in extreme heat and cold. Plastic is also much lighter than metal and can be easily formed into different shapes. This makes the material ideal for countless uses across many different industries. But the widespread use of plastics across the world is causing major problems for the environment. Plastic material is flooding landfills and causing severe damage in the world's oceans. Plastics can take hundreds of years to break down on their own. Very few kinds are highly recyclable. This is because of the way plastics are formed. It has been estimated that even the most reusable kinds of plastic can only be recycled at a rate of 20 to 30%. Even when recycling is possible, the process is costly, can use a lot of energy, and in many cases produces poor quality materials. But a team of researchers working at the U.S. Department of Energy says it has created a kind of plastic that could lead to products that are 100% recyclable. The team works at the Department of Energy's Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory in California. It recently reported the discovery in a study in the journal Nature Chemistry. The researchers say the new material is a plastic polymer called polydicotinamine, or PDK. The team reports that the material can be broken down in parts at the molecular level. It can then be built up again to form plastics of different shapes, textures, colors, and more. The researchers say this process can be repeated over and over again without the plastic material losing any performance or quality. Most plastics were never made to be recycled, lead researcher Peter Christensen said in a statement. Christensen works at Berkeley Lab's Molecular Foundry Center. But we have discovered a new way to assemble plastics that takes recycling into consideration from a molecular perspective. The team explained that all plastics, from water bottles to automobile parts, are made up of polymers with a molecular structure. These polymers are made up of carbon-containing compounds known as monomers. Many plastics have different chemicals added to them to make them more useful and powerful. The problem is that these chemicals attach to the monomers, which remain in the plastics even after the material gets processed at a recycling plant. The research team reported that with the newly discovered PDK material, the monomers could be recovered and separated from any chemical additives. This part of the process would involve putting the plastic material into a highly acidic solution. Brett Helms is a scientist at Berkeley Lab's Molecular Foundry who worked on the study. He said the team is interested in the chemistry that can redirect plastic life cycles from linear to circular. This could be especially important for materials that currently have very few recycling possibilities, he added. Next, the researchers say they plan to develop PDK plastics with a wide range of thermal and mechanical properties. These plastics could be used for many kinds of cloth, as well as things such as 3D printed materials and foams. In addition, the team is looking to include plant-based materials in the process. Helms said the world is currently at a critical point at which new recycling plants and processes need to be developed and modernized to deal with long-lasting plastic waste. New recycling centers could be designed to recycle or upcycle PDK and related plastics. Then we would be able to more effectively divert plastic from landfills and the oceans, Helms said. This is an exciting time to start thinking about how to design both materials and recycling facilities to enable circular plastics, he added. I'm Brian Lynn.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Bob Doty with Steve Ember. We continue the story of the administration of Herbert Hoover, and we talk about the election of 1932.
President Herbert Hoover worked hard to rescue the American economy following the crash of the stock market. It happened in October of 1929. Within a month, Hoover called the nation's business leaders to the White House. "Don't lower wages," the president told them. Hoover called on the bankers at the Federal Reserve to make it easier for businesses to borrow money. He tried to provide funds to help farmers get fair prices for their crops. He pushed Congress to lower personal taxes. And above all, the president urged Americans not to lose hope in their economy or in themselves.
But the economy was in ruins, falling faster with each passing day of the crisis that grew into the Great Depression. The value of stocks had collapsed. Millions of workers lost their jobs. The level of industrial production in the country was less than half of what it had been before the stock market crash. Hoover's efforts were not enough to stop the growing crisis. In ever greater numbers, people called on the president to increase federal spending and provide jobs for people out of work. But the president was a conservative Republican. He did not think it was the responsibility of the federal government to provide relief for poor Americans. And he thought it was wrong to increase spending above the amount of money that the government received in taxes.
The situation seemed out of control. The nation's government and business leaders appeared to have no idea how to save the dollar and put people back to work. Hoover was willing to take steps like spending government money to help farmers buy seeds and fertilizer, but he was not willing to give wheat to unemployed workers who were hungry. He created an emergency committee to study the unemployment problem, but he would not launch government programs to create jobs. Hoover called on Americans to help their friends in need, but he resisted calls to spend federal funds for major relief programs to help the millions of Americans facing disaster.
Leaders of the Democratic Party made the most of the situation. They accused the president of not caring about the common man. They said Hoover was willing to spend money to feed starving cattle for businessmen, but not willing to feed poor children. Hoover tried to show the nation that he was dealing with the crisis. He worked with Congress to try to save the banks and to keep the dollar tied to the value of gold. He tried hard to balance the federal budget. And he told Americans that it was not the responsibility of the national government to solve all their problems.
Late in 1931, President Hoover appointed a new committee on unemployment. He named Walter Gifford to head this committee. Gifford was chief of a big company, American Telephone and Telegraph. But Gifford did Hoover more harm than good. When he appeared before Congress, Gifford was unable to defend Hoover's position that relief was the responsibility of local governments and private giving. He admitted that he did not know how many people were out of work. He did not know how many of them needed help, or how much help they needed, or how much money local governments could raise.
The situation grew worse. Some Americans began to completely lose faith in their government. They looked to groups with extreme political ideas to provide answers. Some Americans joined the Communist Party. Others helped elect state leaders with extreme political ideas. And in growing numbers, people began to turn to hatred and violence. However, most Americans remained loyal to traditional values, even as conditions grew steadily worse. They looked ahead to 1932, when they would have a chance to vote for a new president.
Leaders of the Democratic Party felt they had an excellent chance to capture the White House in the election, and their hopes increased when the Republicans renominated President Hoover and Vice President Charles Curtis in the summer of 1932. For this reason, competition was fierce for the Democratic presidential nomination. The top candidate was Franklin Delano Roosevelt, the governor of New York State. Roosevelt had been re-elected to that office by a large majority just 2 years earlier. He came from a rich and famous family, but he was seen as a friend of the common man. Roosevelt was conservative in his economic thinking, but he was a progressive in his opinion that government should be active in helping people. Roosevelt had suffered from polio and could not walk. He used a wheelchair, although it was rarely shown in news pictures.
Franklin Delano Roosevelt's two main opponents were Al Smith and John Garner. Smith had been the governor of New York before Roosevelt. Garner, a Texan, was the Speaker of the House of Representatives. Together, they hoped to block Roosevelt's nomination, and they succeeded the first three times that delegates voted at the Democratic nominating convention in Chicago. Roosevelt's chief political advisor, James Farley, worked hard to find Roosevelt the votes he needed at the convention. Finally, Farley found a solution. He made a deal with supporters of John Garner. Roosevelt would make Garner the vice presidential nominee if Garner's forces voted to make Roosevelt the presidential nominee. Garner agreed. And on the next vote, the Democratic delegates nominated Franklin Roosevelt to be their presidential candidate. Al Smith was so angry about the deal that he left Chicago without congratulating Roosevelt. Roosevelt wanted to show the nation that he was the kind of man to take action, that he had more imagination than Hoover. So he broke tradition and flew to Chicago. It was the first time a candidate had ever appeared at a convention to accept a nomination. And Roosevelt told the cheering crowd that together they would defeat Hoover.
The main issue in the campaign of 1932 was the economy. President Hoover defended his policies. Roosevelt and the Democrats attacked the administration for not taking enough action. Roosevelt knew that most Americans were unhappy with the Hoover administration. So his plan during the campaign was to let Hoover defeat himself. He avoided saying anything that might make groups of voters think he was too extreme. But Roosevelt did make clear that he would move the federal government into action to help people suffering from the economic crisis. He said he was for a balanced federal budget, but he also said the government must be willing to spend extra money to prevent people from starving.
Americans liked what they heard from Franklin Roosevelt. He seemed strong. He enjoyed life. And Roosevelt seemed willing to try new ideas, to experiment with government. Hoover attacked Roosevelt bitterly during the campaign. He warned that Roosevelt and the Democrats would destroy the American system. But Americans were tired of Hoover. They thought he was too serious, too afraid of change, too friendly with business leaders instead of the working man. Most of all, they blamed Hoover for the hard times of the Depression. On Election Day, Americans voted in huge numbers for Franklin Roosevelt and the Democrats. Roosevelt won 42 of the 48 states at that time. The Democrats also gained a large majority in both houses of Congress.
The election ended 12 years of Republican rule in the White House. It also marked the passing of a long conservative period in American political life. Franklin Delano Roosevelt would become one of the strongest and most progressive presidents in the nation's history. He would serve longer than any other president, changing the face of America's political and economic systems.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.